At the height of the Hutus' mass butchery, U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright washed her and everyone's hands of the genocide, which the United States was denying was a genocide, saying that though the United Nations might eventually do something to help, ultimately the future of Rwanda is in Rwandan hands. She infamously declared that, without a sound plan of operations, intervention would be folly. Aside from the transparent cynicism of her attempt to short-circuit a serious discussion of effective outside intervention by declaring it outside reason's bounds, even though the genocide had been underway for more than a month and hundreds of thousands had been allowed to be butchered, Albright's statement was deemed plausibly correct and adequate by elites and publics alike, as the mute reaction to it confirms. What assumptions made her assertion of folly plausible? Beyond holding up the fig leaf of the need for operational planning, Albright was vague about the reasons for the folly. She thus allowed people to activate the range of reasons that has for decades undergirded the widespread consensus opposing American, and not just American, foreign intervention against mass murder and elimination, which in any case barely registers. I list them in no particular order and without maintaining they are equally widespread, central, or openly articulated. It is not in the United States' national interest to enter conflicts not tangibly and substantially affecting the United States or its close allies. It is their conflict, let them settle it. The local situation is too complicated. There are killing and atrocities on both sides, as there often are in war. American boys should not die to save another country's people. They are just a bunch of barbarians killing each other. We cannot solve the problem anyway. Why should we pay for their actions? It is not our right to intervene. Let the international community or nearby countries do it. We have too many important priorities at home. These excuses for allowing hundreds of thousands to be slaughtered abroad would never be tolerated by Americans, Britons, Germans, Spanish, Italians, or Japanese if applied to the similar slaughter of, say, only 100 people in any of their own countries, or even of a close Western ally. For peoples in faraway or seemingly enormously different countries, these powerfully effective excuses are grounded in three factors that produce policy detachment: an overriding doctrine of national interest, racism, and a failure to morally engage the issues. To start with the last, I have yet to see anyone address two related questions. How many African or Asian lives is one American life worth? Why is the American life deemed so much more valuable? Put differently, why do we value the life of an American, or in Germany a German, in the United Kingdom a Briton, in Italy an Italian, in Japan a Japanese, so much more highly than African or Asian lives in the thousands, tens of thousands, or hundreds of thousands? How can this be justified morally or even politically? Putting the question this way dissolves many of the thoughtlessly uttered justifications for allowing, which is in effect enabling, the killing of thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions, and the habitual assent those justifications find. The racism of people in the West is palpable, if usually unarticulated, when it comes to mass murders and eliminations among peoples of color. Racism underlines the "they are just barbarians" mentality, and the "these people are governed by uncontrollable primordial hatreds" explanation, which offer the speaker and his listeners implicit justification for inaction. This dismissive reasoning ignores first that these putative barbarians' political and military leaders are, with few exceptions, university graduates, sophisticated and well-spoken, and often thoroughly westernized. Second, in all exterminationist and other eliminationist assaults, political leaders, for ideological and political reasons, coolly practice their destructive politics. And third, Perpetrators everywhere are moved by various overlapping or kindred notions, prejudices, and hatreds that lead them to think the killing is right. This was true of civilized Germans and their many collaborators in many other civilized European countries during the Nazi period, no less than uncivilized Hutu in Rwanda, Serbs in Bosnia or Kosovo, or Muslim tribesmen in Sudan today. Finally, the doctrine of national interest, much criticized in the scholarly international relations literature, has gained such currency in the United States and other countries, such as France. Even conceptions of national interest vary substantively from country to country, as to squelch serious questioning of its conventional wisdom. That Secretary of State Warren Christopher would unashamedly declare in July 1993 that the United States was following its national interest in Bosnia as a definitive justification for why it should stand idly by and let the Serbs continue mass murdering and eliminating Muslims conveys the power of the national interest doctrine. The most basic question, why so-called national interest should be the governing concept for acting internationally, is hardly asked. In the United States in particular, even those wanting to intervene against annihilationist assaults appear to think themselves obliged to assert that such intervention is in the American national interest. They support this assertion by arguing that American values are part of the country's interests, and the United States' moral standing in the world, and therefore American interests, will be detrimentally affected if the United States does not intervene, or by offering some other unconvincing attempt to employ the lowest moral denominator language to an end for which it is palpably unsuited. Political leaders and other elites would object to aspects of this analysis, such as racism. Yet they would accept the power of the national interest as a source of their inaction, but not see it as revealing failures or as an indictment, but as a justifiable, even laudatory principle for their do-nothing stances. There is, however, another class of reasons for political leaders' inaction, which few today would justify openly. Some political leaders and their followers choose to overlook eliminationist assaults as they transpire because they care more about countervailing geopolitical or economic considerations. States and their leaders often give tacit support, remain silent, or make quiet pro forma objections when allies or other important countries commit mass murders or eliminations. Aside from a few tepid and oblique objections, this has characterized virtually every state's stance toward the Russians' mass murdering and vast destruction in Chechnya. Among world leaders, the Chinese's decades-long eliminationist campaign in Tibet to Sinofy the region barely meets a whispered criticism unless open conflict erupts, as it did in spring 2008 during the lead-up to that summer's Olympic Games in Beijing. The more powerful the country perpetrating mass murder and elimination, the more states and political leaders would pay materially or diplomatically for speaking out. So, unless a powerful motive impels them to object or to take symbolic or more effective action, they usually keep quiet. Some political leaders, elites, and peoples ignore mass slaughters and eliminationist campaigns because they identify or sympathize with the perpetrators. The most obvious ones are those of Arab and other Islamic countries who have consistently refused to condemn mass murders of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands committed by Arab states. Assad in Syria, Saddam in Iraq, al-Bashir first in southern Sudan and then in Darfur, while vociferously condemning Israelis for every Palestinian they kill. Their total or near-total silence is mirrored by their counterparts in Europe and around the world supporting Palestinian nationalism, or so hostile to the United States and Israel that they are loath to criticize the enemies of those they hate. Although not mass murder or elimination, the Americans' crimes in Abu Ghraib prison and elsewhere in Iraq should be mentioned in this context. Many American commentators' unwillingness to speak plainly and forcefully, though of course many others have done so, about the extent of Americans' systematic torturing of imprisoned Iraqis and the responsibility for them that went up the chain of command is not in essence different, even if the deeds are markedly different, from Arab political and media elites' refusal to speak plainly and forcefully about Arab and Islamic states' mass murdering and eliminations. The unwillingness to criticize here, as elsewhere, reflected the general political allegiance many American commentators had for the United States' toppling of Saddam, or for the Bush administration generally. They failed to differentiate between the justness of the war itself and its strategic goals, in which they believe, and the justness of aspects of how Americans fought the war, which many of them certainly privately abhor and should condemn. We see, then, that another factor is necessary for eliminationist and exterminationist politics to be practiced, which, though obvious, is overlooked perhaps because it is not seen as a constituent factor actively promoting and therefore helping to produce eliminationist assaults. That factor is a permissive outside world unwilling to use its great power to prevent most any regime or perpetrators from consummating their destructive ambitions. The Genocide Convention and the United Nations do more to provide cover for mass murderers than to stop them, and in only a few instances has there been effective intervention to prevent the further annihilation and expulsion of more victims. The price paid by those practicing such politics, owing to actions taken by the international community, has, in historical terms, been minuscule. The current international political system in which eliminationist politics is embedded is, whatever its self-presentations, amenable to mass murder, expulsions, and eliminationist politics. As I discuss in Chapter 11, this can be altered. How eliminationist assaults end. The discussion of the international environment regarding eliminationist politics and the essential immorality of those acting within it provides the necessary context for investigating why individual mass murders and eliminations have ended, and why they did so when they did and not earlier. Understanding political leaders' failure to intervene to stop the world's greatest horrors explains why eliminationist assaults have ended. Not because of world outrage, not because of mobilization against mass murder, but because of internal developments among the perpetrators or external happenstance. The Germans' annihilation of the Herero proceeded apace without external pressure or serious internal condemnation, ending only when the Germans had killed enough, about 80%, to solve their Herero problem. It was then that German Chancellor von Bülow pressured the Kaiser, for presumptive reputational reasons, to stop the wanton mass murder. The Germans had more or less finished the job and, in any case, after the mass murder's formal cessation, continued to assault the Herero with other brutal, though mainly non-lethal, eliminationist means. The Belgians stopped their gargantuan annihilation of Congo's people in 1908 on their own accord. The Turks' annihilation of the Armenians similarly did not falter until they had depopulated Anatolia of Armenians and accomplished their eliminationist goal. With the Russian Tsar's overthrow, the Turks seized the opportunity to restart their annihilationist assault in 1918 to slaughter Armenians who had fled Turkey to Transcaucasia, known as Russian Armenia, and Armenians already living there. The Indonesians stopped slaughtering communists because they decided the job was finished. The Pakistanis ceased killing Bengalis only upon being militarily defeated by the Indians, who fought the Pakistanis for their own geostrategic reasons. Assad stopped slaughtering Hama's people when the destruction was sufficiently horrific to deter other Syrians from challenging his dictatorship. Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge had to be defeated by the Vietnamese, who fought the war not as anti-eliminationists — they, after all, had their own gulag — but because the Khmer Rouge attacked Vietnam. And the many mass murderers of indigenous peoples around the world, all but ignored by the international community, have killed and expelled these internationally invisible peoples and then stopped, according to their own rhythms and self-conceived needs. Annihilationist and eliminationist regimes targeting various peoples often end the various assaults in their own ways. The Soviets' eliminationist policies went through various phases, which individually came to an end when Joseph Stalin deemed the job completed, or when it seemed prudent to desist, such as during the war with Germany. After the war, Stalin resumed purges, although on a smaller scale, which ceased only with the regime's change upon his death in 1953. The Communist Party continued to rule the Soviet Union. Yet its new leaders decided to break with Stalin's eliminationist politics, so only days after he died, they began to end the regime's terror and close down the gulag. Similarly, Saddam stopped the murderous assault upon the Kurds, the Marsh people, and the rebellious Shia when he was satisfied the job was well enough done. Yet his general murderousness ended only when the Americans and British deposed him for geostrategic reasons having nothing to do with his domestic slaughters and eliminations. An accounting of the cessation of the Germans' mass murdering of the Jews, and then of other targeted groups and peoples, differs by country and group. For the Jews, the Germans and their collaborators' mass murdering in a country or region, such as in Lithuania, ended, except for the hunting down of those in hiding, when they succeeded in annihilating the country's Jews or deporting them for extermination elsewhere. For other targeted groups, such as the Polish elite, whose members the Germans partly targeted in 1939 and 1940, the Germans stopped their concerted campaign upon achieving their temporary goal. But their general mass murdering ended in a country or region, and then completely, only with military rollback and then defeat by the Allies, who themselves were fighting not because of the Germans' eliminationist assaults per se, but because they needed to destroy the regime waging an apocalyptic war of continental conquest. Had the Germans not been defeated, they might never have been stopped. Because their blueprint for the world, mandating the master race's subjugation and exploitation of all lesser races, would have required an unprecedented scale of destruction and ongoing use of all eliminationist means, repression, expulsion, transformation, prevention of reproduction, and extermination, to keep the lesser races dragooned and sufficiently diminished as to be controllable. The Germans' allies in mass murder in Vichy France and Yugoslavia, in Slovakia, including the Slovakian Catholic Church, stopped their eliminationist programs as the job was reaching completion, or the Germans' fortunes waned and occupation ended. The end of the Japanese mass murdering resembled the Germans, with the crescendo having been Americans' military unnecessary twin counter-slaughters in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Our age's other gargantuan mass murder regime, in communist China, also had ebbs and flows in its eliminationist policies and targets, which Mao, ideologically driven, turned on and off according to the intersection of his political goals and his read of changing conditions. He stopped the colossally murderous Great Leap Forward, for example, almost overnight in 1961. As with the Soviets, the general exterminationist policies ended through internal regime change, finally stopped for good, at least on an epic scale, by Mao's death in 1976. Yet the Chinese continue their imperialist eliminationist program in Tibet. No matter where on the globe or when in our time one looks, the basic findings do not change. With few exceptions, eliminationist and exterminationist programs have ended because, 1, the perpetrators reached their goals, 2, there was internal change owing to a leader's death, the perpetrating regime took a new direction or it was overthrown, or 3, the states lost wars that were waged against them, not to stop mass murders and eliminations, but for other reasons. Outside intervention with the explicit intent to stop mass murder or eliminations, such as NATO's late interventions in Bosnia and Kosovo, and the United Nations' insertion of peacekeepers in East Timor in 1999, has almost never happened. Even serious and effective sanctions expressly targeted to stop mass murdering regimes from slaughtering more people have almost never been imposed. And those regimes that stopped their mass killing for their own reasons, not because of military defeat, often continue to assault the same groups and peoples using other eliminationist means, including camps. As much as political leaders have learned they can slaughter with impunity, they know even better that lesser eliminationist measures, including expulsion, incarceration in camps, and the destruction of towns and homes, are in themselves that much less likely to produce a concerted international effort to thwart them. Could these and other mass murders and eliminations have been stopped earlier? In so many instances, the answer is obviously yes, or the international community or powerful countries could have at least made serious attempts offering a reasonable probability of success. In Burundi, the Tutsis' wanton butchery of Hutu, targeting the Hutu elite and middle class, lasted from May to July 1972. The personalized killing, face-to-face with machetes, was an inverted precursor to the Rwandan mass murder 2.5 decades later. The world's political leaders knew of the Burundian killing on a scale that at least resembled genocide while it was underway. Only the Belgians, the region's former colonials, made even token noises to stop the killing. The Secretary General of the African Union, OAU, African country's major international political organization, visited Burundi's capital during the height of the slaughter and formally declared, "The OAU being essentially an organization based on solidarity, my presence here signifies the total solidarity of the Secretariat with the President of Burundi, with the government and the fraternal people of Burundi." UN Secretary General Kurt Waldheim was only slightly less craven in his public enabling of the mass murder. He conveyed his fervent hopes that peace, harmony, and stability can be brought about successfully and speedily, that Burundi will thereby achieve the goals of social progress, better standards of living, and other ideals and principles set forth in the UN Charter. This was the United Nations' official response to a frenzy of killing that led the U.S. Embassy's chief of mission to cable the State Department, "No respite, no let-up." What apparently is a genocide continues, arrests going on around the clock. Yet American President Richard Nixon did nothing. The U.S. Congress never discussed the matter. No economic pressure, which would have been virtually cost-free to the United States, was put on this desperately poor country. Intervention to save Africans' lives in an all but militarily defenseless country did not take place. The possibility seems never to have occurred to anyone. The four other instances of Tutsi perpetrating substantial slaughters of Hutu in Burundi elicited effectively no response from the international community. Similarly, in Chile, Argentina, El Salvador, and elsewhere in Latin America, where U.S. influence with their rightist governments was vast, the Americans had enormous power and could have halted the mass murders and eliminations at little cost. In some instances, it may have taken but a few words. But as we know, in some instances, the United States actively or tacitly encouraged the slaughters. As Clinton has now conceded about the Guatemalan regime's murder of 200,000 people in its eliminationist campaign, mainly aimed at Maya, it is important that I state clearly that American support for military forces or intelligence units which engaged in violent and widespread repression of the kind described in the report was wrong. Indeed, it was not just support for such forces, and it was not just violent and widespread repression, as bad as that would be. It was much worse. The United States set the contours of the national security policy that informed the Guatemalan and other regimes and helped train the Guatemalan security forces in the counterinsurgency tactics they would use against Maya communities. The violent repression included widespread mass slaughter and expulsion. The Guatemalans' exterminationist and eliminationist assault against the Maya came to an end when the Guatemalan leadership that deposed Rios Montt decided the eliminationist task had been sufficiently completed as to render their self-conceived Mayan problem solved. In the aftermath of the first Gulf War, the duplicitous President George H.W. Bush's American administration first encouraged southern Iraq's marsh people to rebel against Saddam and then forsook them. Although the Americans had just pulverized the now defenseless Saddam's military capacity, he and his armed forces proceeded to wage a lethal exterminationist campaign against the marsh people, systematically exterminating them and laying waste to their villages and region, killing perhaps 40,000 and driving hundreds of thousands from their homes forever. During the 1992 assault, British Member of Parliament Emma Nicholson reported, "Saddam has stepped up his onslaught in the marshes themselves. I traveled through marshes smoking from ground-launched bombardments. Reed-built villages have been razed, their small rice plots burned. I reached the heart of the marshes, 1 mile from Saddam's front line. There I found people starving, desperate people, drinking filthy water and eating contaminated fish. They had fled villages under assault by Saddam's forces. Many refugees like these have made the dash across the border into Iran. But to make the crossing, they must brave mined waters and a line of Saddam's soldiers." Nicholson knew about it. The British government knew about it. The Americans knew about it. Everyone knew about it, including the coalition of more than 30 countries whose troops had just defeated the Iraqi army and ended Saddam's imperial conquest of Kuwait. Yet they did nothing because geopolitical considerations, wanting to maintain Iraq as a countervailing force against Iran, not wanting to alienate the Americans' Arab coalition allies by invading an Arab country, took precedence. If ever an instance existed for the absolute necessity of American intervention to stop mass murder and elimination, this was it. The Americans had encouraged the rebellion that catalyzed Saddam's murderous eliminationist campaign. The mass murderer had just provoked a war with the United States, which soundly defeated him, and overpowering American military force was at hand. Nevertheless, Bush let the slaughter proceed unimpeded. The eliminationist assaults in the former Yugoslavia by Serbs, first against Bosnians and Croats, then Kosovars, and by Croats against Serbs, are more instances of how little political leaders are willing to do to stop mass murder, even at their doorstep. European nations, their political and media elites alike, often present themselves as paragons of moral conscience in contrast to the avaricious American colossus. Yet European governments, individually and collectively, stood by and watched systematic mass murder return after less than a half century's absence to their continent. Some European voices urged intervention, but these were relatively weak and ineffectual. The major and minor countries' political leaders and political classes did all they could to look the other way, explain away the problem as not being genocidal or as being intractable, failed to act forcefully, and drag their feet. In some instances, such as the Germans' premature recognition of Slovenian independence in violation of European Union policy, they actually helped precipitate the various stages of the crisis. All in all, the Europeans did nothing discernible to break the killings and expulsions. Neither did the United States under Bush and during the Clinton administration's first 3 years, even though the first Bush administration knew about the Serbs' mass murderous and eliminationist designs on Bosnia before the assault began, and immediately understood the assault for what it was once it did begin. Had Bush or Clinton decided to meet Slobodan Milosevic with a credible threat of the actual force Clinton eventually did effectively apply, just serious bombing, the Serbs would not have slaughtered tens of thousands of Muslims, brutally expelled hundreds of thousands, or raped enormous numbers of women, and a more just cultural and political settlement would have emerged from Yugoslavia's breakup. Only when Clinton, much too late, used American air power in Kosovo in what was formally, as it had also been in Bosnia, a NATO intervention, was Milosevic's eliminationist rampage in the West Europeans' backyard finally halted. The story in Rwanda is even more sordid. The French, serving as the Francophone Hutus' guardians, and UN leaders possessed explicit advance knowledge that the Hutu leadership intended to embark upon a colossal mass murder of the Tutsi. The French had even armed and trained the eventual murderers. Did French President François Mitterrand or the head of the UN peacekeeping force, Kofi Annan, later rewarded with a promotion to UN Secretary General, warn the Tutsi or the world? No. Did they tell the Hutu political leadership that the international community would intervene to stop them and would treat them as criminals if they proceeded with the mass murder? No. Did they seek to mobilize troops to intervene, or even just to make a credible threat that might give the regime pause? No. What did they do? First, when General Roméo Dallaire, the military commander of the UN peacekeeping force in Rwanda, informed Annan of the Hutus' plan to exterminate Tutsi leaders and Belgian peacekeepers to get the United Nations to withdraw its peacekeepers, Annan forbade Dallaire from intervening to protect the Tutsi, an order Annan never rescinded. Annan and Mitterrand kept quiet about the plans, providing cover for the mass murderers. Once the killing began, the United Nations withdrew its troops, abandoning the Tutsi and giving the Hutu the green light to slaughter them. The French did eventually send soldiers, which they have had no compunction to do in Africa to serve their interests, though here it was not to stop, but effectively facilitate the butchery by protecting the Hutu regime. The rest of the world mobilized very late in the killing process to send some troops in order to create a few safe havens, but not to stop the mass murdering more generally, although halting the poorly armed and trained perpetrators would have been easy. The killing continued until a Tutsi army invading Rwanda from Uganda defeated the Hutu militarily. The French political leaders were at the helm of a democratic country that, like other democracies, is generally supportive of human rights. Why then did they collaborate in a mass murder that was of an intensity, number killed per month, that exceeded the German slaughter of European Jews? Because the Hutu are Francophones, and the Tutsis from Uganda who threatened the Hutus' tyrannical rule are not. The French, engaged in a virtually magical realist struggle to maintain their waning cultural importance around the world, decided that their self-image trumped the lives of 800,000 men, women, and children. Why did Annan willfully permit the mass annihilation to proceed unimpeded? In calculating his chances for further elevation to UN Secretary General, intervention, going against the international community's status quo hands-off policies, would likely have made a mortal enemy of France, a UN Security Council permanent member. In Rwanda, the world failed to work to stop the colossal slaughter taking place in full view, which it easily could have done at any of several stages, including before its inception. Some of its leading members also made the bloodbath possible, or at least far more likely and more deadly. The far more formidable Taliban ruling Afghanistan, home to the genocidal Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, was toppled easily by a mainly American campaign aided by an international expeditionary force. It took the American and Allied forces only 2 weeks after inserting troops, following bombing, to rout the regime. Subsequent strategic and tactical blunders have allowed a powerful insurgency to grow. Unusual for a Western power, the United States was highly motivated to act against this mass-murdering regime for the obvious reason that it was the haven and staging ground for Al-Qaeda, which had destroyed the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center on 9/11, damaged the Pentagon, killed 3,000 people, and stunned and mobilized the American people. Would the motivation have been there had the Taliban or Bin Laden slaughtered 3,000 Afghanis? Or 10,000? Or even 100,000? Of course not. Each of the many other instances of large domestic killing repeatedly answers this question for the United States and the powerful countries in the negative. Dislodging the Hutu genocidal regime in geographically small Rwanda, one of the world's poorest countries, would have been easy and not very costly. But 800,000 Tutsis' lives are evidently less valuable than 3,000 American lives. These instances show how little the world, the United Nations, the major powers, the political decision makers, have done even when it would have been relatively easy to stop mass murder. The world's political heavyweights do not act to save innocent lives because the nation-state is egoistic and its leaders are self-interested, and because the lives of people who are deemed to be unlike those living in the powerful countries are devalued. As Dallaire in 2004 said about the Hutus' slaughter of the Tutsi, "I still believe that if an organization decided to wipe out the 320 mountain guerrillas, there would be still more of a reaction by the international community to curtail or to stop that than there would be still today in attempting to protect thousands of human beings being slaughtered in the same country." Once the mechanisms that have stopped mass murder and eliminations are known, the question as to why eliminations do not end earlier than they do mainly answers itself. In almost all of our time's mass slaughters and eliminations, the leaders of the powerful international institutions and states, the effective agents capable of stopping a dedicated eliminationist regime, have not acted at all. So, obviously, they were never going to intervene early to stop, let alone prevent, the catastrophes, while tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of lives could be saved. Intervention can take place. The horrible record of countries and their leaders need not be reproduced forever. To bring about effective change, we need to consider how we can transform the international environment regarding eliminationist politics, including the incentive structure that potential mass murderers and eliminationists confront, and how to promote right and necessary action among the world's powerful political actors.